there's no choice.
Okay, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Let me thank our guests on the phone from the Answer Coalition. We have Richard Becker in San Francisco, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell joined us from Malloy, Iowa. Up in your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
Headlines. Iran calls on the IAEA to inspect Israel's nuclear sites, saying that the regime's blatant threats to use nuclear weapons must not be tolerated by the international community. The Taliban agreed to let 200 American civilians and third country nationals who remained in Afghanistan after the end of the U.S. evacuation operation leave. And China slams the U.S. for sailing a warship through the South China Sea, calling it evidence of Washington's hegemony and militarization of the strategic waters.
Welcome to your world news, coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says nuclear disarmament must remain a top priority for the world. Majid Takht Ravanchi urged the international community to press nuclear weapon states to fulfill their legal obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Iranian diplomat singled out the United States for having conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests since 1945. He also said Israel's possession of weapons of mass destruction and its threats to use them must not be tolerated. Takht Ravanchi made the remarks at the high-level plenary meeting of the UN General Assembly on the International Day Against Nuclear Tests. U.S. Secretary of State says time is running out for Iran to, quote, return to the nuclear deal.
I'm not going to put a date on it, but we are getting closer to the point at which a strict return to compliance with the JCPOA does not reproduce the benefits that that agreement achieved.
Antony Blinken's remarks come after the International Atomic Energy Agency released a strongly worded report Tuesday criticizing what it called Tehran's lack of cooperation. The day after the IAEA report, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi said his country has been transparent about its nuclear activities. Raisi also stressed that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sticking to its predecessor's policy of sanctions and pressure against the Islamic Republic. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018. Iran wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner and assure it will not exit the deal again. Political commentator Dundabar says the International Atomic Energy Agency is ignoring the U.S. violations under the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Listen.
That the IAEA says Iran is not living up to I said, but there are no other parties that are actually involved in it of any consequence. Without the U.S., it's a meaningless treaty. And the very same agency and the very same director general of that agency that's issued this report about Iran, when issuing a general statement back in June, went after, by coincidence for some reason, after discussing all 173 members, more or less, in some detail, only these three adversaries of the U.S., Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, North Korea, and Syria, which the U.S. has been conducting a war against for the past 10 years. It's not hard to see what the, with doing the arithmetic, that the IAEA is acting as a puppet for, but with, you have both the director general there winking at the violations by the U.S. without mentioning them. You have Blinken, of course, issuing this statement, and then President Nod in the White House, who's obviously sleeping through all of this stuff, and will ultimately threaten Iran with this or that sanction.
The U.S. says the Taliban have agreed to allow some 200 American civilians and third country nationals who remained in Afghanistan following the August 31st deadline to leave the country. An American official said on the condition of anonymity that the Taliban were pressed to allow the departures by U.S. Special Representative in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad. The departures are expected on Thursday. The official, however, did not say whether the U.S. and third country nationals were among people stranded for days in Mazar-e-Sharif because their private charters had not been allowed to depart. In an agreement signed in February 2020, the U.S. agreed to withdraw all of its forces from the country by the end of August. Afghanistan's acting prime minister has called on former government officials to return to the country. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Ahund promised amnesty for anyone who's worked alongside the United States and the former pro-U.S. government. Ahund also said the caretaker government would guarantee the security of diplomats, embassies, and humanitarian organizations. He added that the Taliban seek positive and strong relations with the world. The comments came a day after the Taliban announced their interim government.
Almost 3 weeks after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and only a few days after the group's spokesman declared victory of Panjshir clash, the Taliban announced the lineup of its caretaker government.
Mohtaram Al-Haj Muhammad Hassan Ahund has been appointed as the acting prime minister. Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar and Maulavi Abdus Salam Hanafi will serve as his deputies. Maulavi Muhammad Yaqub Mujahid and Al-Haj Mullah Sirajuddin Haqqani are also appointed as the acting defense and interior ministers. Maulavi Amir Khan Muttaqi serves as acting foreign minister of the caretaker government.
The declaration of the caretaker government of Taliban has sparked mixed reactions inside and abroad. Many have criticized the Taliban for not forming an inclusive government. They, for instance, argue that all members of the newly declared acting cabinet ministers are Taliban figures. Moreover, the absence of women in Taliban's caretaker government is considered as one of the other causes behind rising criticism among Afghans, especially women. In protest to the lineup of Taliban's caretaker government, Afghan women took to the streets of Kabul and voiced their anger at the absence of women in the newly declared cabinet ministers. Despite this, Taliban officials insist that they are fully committed to respect and even protect women's rights. They also said will declare an inclusive government that will remove all current public concerns and criticisms.
Our country is facing numerous challenges, mainly poverty. Furthermore, the country has just left behind a crisis. Now security is restored to all parts of the country. So we declared this caretaker government to manage the urgent in a better way. We will, of course, declare an inclusive government soon.
We want security and don't care who brings it to us. If they are right, the Taliban must help us go back to our village in northeastern Badakhshan. I also ask the Taliban to avoid any further violence in the country by establishing an inclusive government.
Besides local reactions to the declaration of Taliban's government, Some states, including China and Uzbekistan, have welcomed this recent move of Taliban in terms of declaring and acting cabinet ministers. Some other countries, however, insist that the only legitimate government in Afghanistan will be the one which must take power based on the will of the people of Afghanistan. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
China has slammed the United States for sailing a warship through the South China Sea, calling it a violation of its sovereignty and security. In a statement, the Chinese military called the move illegal and ironclad evidence of Washington's hegemony and militarization of the strategic waters. The U.S. dismissed the accusations by calling them false and excessive. The U.S.-guided missile destroyer USS Benfold sailed near the Spratly Islands, on Wednesday, just a few days after China imposed new identification rules that apply to the disputed body of water. China claims the South China Sea in its entirety. However, some of its neighbors have also overlapping claims, and the U.S. sides with Beijing's rivals in the dispute. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says there is an inescapable irony regarding the U.S. moves and policies in the South China Sea. Listen.
Beijing is losing patience. There does not seem to be a constructive dialogue. This idea that the U.S. is there to protect a treaty, UNCLOS, which is not a part of, deliberately would not sign it because they would not adhere to the idea that there could be any impingement on its sovereignty, is now insisting that it has the right to impose UNCLOS on other sovereign nations. The irony is inescapable, but it has not stopped the U.S., which continues to try to provoke this. There's some feeling that they are trying to keep tensions on a knife edge without going over. This type of kind of gumboat diplomacy is fraught with danger. China's had 40 years of success. During that same 40-year period, the U.S. has gone sideways in so many ways, in some ways backwards, in terms of social policies, African Americans, civil rights, and now even voting. So at this juncture, China's success is an existential threat to the U.S. because the U.S. believes that there is only one way of governance. It is a liberal, democratic capitalism.
Palestinians rally in the occupied West Bank in support of prisoners in Israeli jails as the regime imposes new restrictions on inmates. Israeli forces attacked the demonstrators, injuring 100 Palestinians. Many Palestinian inmates also protested at the regime's repressive actions. Israel's boosting of prison security comes after six Palestinian men broke out of a maximum security jail this week. The regime flooded the occupied territories with troops in a massive manhunt operation. Israel deployed drones and an army mission to Jenin, the hometown of many of the escapees. Israeli troops also arrested several relatives of escaped Palestinians. The six staged their jailbreak through a hole they had dug under a sink in a prison cell, reportedly using a spoon. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Mona Kandil, in the occupied West Bank. She gave us more details about the latest Palestinian protests against Israeli crackdown on Palestinian prisoners. Here's more.
Palestinians had demonstrated in several areas of the occupied West Bank, in Nablus, in Jenin, in Beit Lahem, in Ariha, also known as Jericho, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, and in Ramallah. As well, demonstrations have taken place to the areas where Israeli military checkpoints are located, and Palestinians have clashed with the Israeli forces in Nablus, for example, and mainly in the village of Beita, as well as at the checkpoint of Hawara, South Nablus. Palestinians had clashed with the Israeli forces. We are speaking about 100 Palestinians had been wounded during the night demonstrations that had taken place in support of the Palestinian prisoners. Also in Al-Khalil, known as Hebron, dozens of Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces, who fired heavy tear gas and stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets, in order to disperse the protesters in Ramallah, at the military checkpoint of Beit Eil. Also, similar clashes have taken place between the Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters.
Japan says it will extend emergency COVID-19 prevention restrictions in the capital, Tokyo, and some other regions until the end of this month. The move is aimed at containing infections and preventing hospitals from being overwhelmed. Japan has been struggling with a fifth wave of the virus. Last month, the country extended its long-running curbs until the 12th of September to cover about 80% of its population. However, the number of severe cases and the strain on the medical system has not eased sufficiently in Tokyo and its surrounding areas. Nevertheless, there are some signs of improvement around the nation. Two prefectures out of 21 will move from the state of emergency to more targeted restrictions. A number of other prefectures will also remove all curbs. The World Health Organization has called on countries to avoid giving out third COVID jabs until year end, pointing to the millions worldwide who have yet to receive a single dose.
Today, I'm calling for an extension of the moratorium until at least the end of the year to enable every country to vaccinate at least 40% of its population.
Tedros Ghebreyesus urged wealthy countries and vaccine makers to prioritize getting the first jabs to health workers and vulnerable populations in poorer nations over boosters. He said widespread use of boosters for healthy people who are fully vaccinated is not necessary. Tedros added that high-income countries had promised to donate more than 1 billion vaccine doses to poorer countries, but less than 15% of those doses have so far materialized. The southeastern U.S. state of Louisiana confirms 11 more fatalities from Hurricane Ida, raising the overall death toll there to 26. According to the Louisiana Department of Health, all the 11 victims were from the city of New Orleans. Nine of them, above 60, died from excessive heat during an extended power outage following the storm. Two deaths were also blamed on carbon monoxide poisoning. Ida struck Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane in late August, destroying many homes and leaving more than a million people without power. It then lashed out the region with heavy rains and flooding on its way north as it weakened into a tropical storm. At least 50 people lost their lives as the remnants of Ida pummeled several northeastern states, including New York and New Jersey. Brazil's chief justice has slammed President Jair Bolsonaro's practices as anti-democratic and illicit, the day after he attacked the Supreme Court for authorizing an investigation into his conduct. Luis Fox said the Supreme Court will not tolerate threats to the authority of its decisions. He added that challenges to judicial decisions should not be carried out through disobedience and provoking chaos, but through official ways. The reaction by the court came after Bolsonaro on Tuesday appeared among its or his supporters in a rally and vowed not to respect rulings by a judge who ordered that the president must be probed. The investigation will look into accusations of systematically spreading fake news by Bolsonaro and his inner circle.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by his power and brought the sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The Limelight.
Michael McCall, the top Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said that the situation in Afghanistan is worse than before the September 11 terrorist attacks because the Taliban are fully armed with American weaponry. Here we present you an article concerning this issue by staff writers of France Press News Agency under the heading Biden under pressure as NGO says flights from Afghanistan blocked. The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Biden administration is facing mounting pressure amid reports that several hundred people, including Americans, had been prevented for a week from flying out of an airport in northern Afghanistan. Marina Lee Green, the founder and executive director of a small American NGO active in Afghanistan, said 600 to 1,300 people, including girls from her group, had been waiting near the Mazar-e-Sharif airport for as long as a week amid confusion involving the Taliban and U.S. officials. That number is understood to include 19 Americans, though none are with Lee Gree's group. She said those waiting are being housed in various places in the city. Lee Gree told AFP it's been several days and nothing is moving, adding that 6 chartered planes were waiting at the airport to evacuate what some officials are calling the NGO group. Taliban are simply not letting anything move.
Her Virginia-based organization, which supposedly trains Afghan girls in leadership through physical activities like mountain climbing, is trying to evacuate a small group of girls and young women aged 16 to 23 and a few family members. All are Hazara, an ethnic minority in Afghanistan that faced severe repression when the Taliban last controlled the country from 1996 to 2001. Lee Gree, who has worked in Afghanistan since 2005 for U.S. agencies, expressed frustration with the role of the State Department in clearing the flights. The group's departure had seemed imminent until a few days ago when planning suddenly stopped. A State Department spokesperson said recently that while the U.S. is committed to helping Americans at risk Afghans leave, its resources in Afghanistan are seriously limited. The spokesperson told AFP, "We do not have personnel on the ground. We do not have air assets in the country. We do not have control the airspace, whether over Afghanistan or elsewhere in the region." The spokesperson noted, "Given these constraints, we also do not have a reliable means to confirm the basic details of charter flights, including who may be organizing them, the number of U.S. citizens and other priority groups on board, the accuracy of the rest of the manifest, and where they plan to land," adding, "We will hold the Taliban to its pledge to let people freely depart Afghanistan." Satellite images of the airport from September 3rd show six aircraft, one on a runway and others outside terminal buildings. Biden's Republican opposition has seized on the situation, which comes at a time when his popularity has fallen sharply amid concerns about the Afghanistan evacuation and the summer surge in COVID-19 cases. Michael McCaul, the top Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, suggested on Sunday, September 5th, that the Taliban was holding the group as part of the high-pressure negotiations with Washington. But Lee Gree said she would not characterize the situation that way. She said nobody is guarding the door, even if her concern has grown as days pass. She said, "If it isn't resolved very soon, we are worried for the physical safety of our girls." Eric Montalvo, a former U.S. Marine Corps officer and a lawyer working with groups that chartered two of the six planes, said, "Taliban is not holding these planes hostage. The problem is the U.S. government. All the State Department has to do is to make a phone call and these people will be able to leave immediately." McCall said hundreds of American citizens are still in Afghanistan, but Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently claimed under 200 and likely closer to 100 American citizens were still in the country. Speaking to reporters on Friday, September 3rd, Blinken said that the department was in constant contact with Americans in Afghanistan still and want to leave. He noted, "Most of the remaining American citizens are dual nationals whose home is Afghanistan and whose extended families live there. So it's no surprise that deciding whether or not to leave the place they call home is a wrenching decision." Meanwhile, White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain estimated on Sunday, September 5th, that about 100 Americans were still left in Afghanistan waiting to be evacuated by U.S. forces. Klain told CNN, "We believe it's around 100. We are in touch with all of them who we have identified on a regular basis." He claimed, "Obviously, we are hopeful that in the coming days, the Qataris will be able to resume air service out of Kabul. And if they do, we are obviously going to look to see if Americans can be part of those flights. We are going to find ways to get them, the ones that want to leave, to get them out of Afghanistan." Some rescue groups told the media that they are concerned that some Americans and individuals are missing from the White House's count of people who are waiting to be evacuated. The U.S. completed its military withdrawal from Afghanistan on August 31st after weeks of chaos after the Taliban's rapid takeover of the country. More than 120,000 people were flown out of Afghanistan in one of the largest such aerial operations in history, though U.S. officials acknowledged having left a few hundred Americans behind, along with many vulnerable Afghans. The Biden administration has repeatedly claimed to do everything possible to help those who want to leave. On Monday, September 6, the State Department announced that four American citizens had been able to leave Afghanistan by road, arriving in an unnamed neighboring country without any resistance from the Taliban. They were the first officially acknowledged U.S. departures since August 31st. The Taliban are poised to run Afghanistan again 20 years after they were removed from power by American occupation forces following the suspicious September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in October 2001 and removed the Taliban from power. American forces occupied the country for about two decades on the pretext of fighting against the Taliban, but as the U.S. forces left Afghanistan, the Taliban stormed Kabul, weakened by continued foreign occupation. McCall also said the situation in Afghanistan is worse than before the September 11 terrorist attacks because the Taliban are fully armed with American weaponry. McCall said, "We're going to back to pre-9/11 right now, but it's worse. It's worse because now they're fully armed with our weapons, our helicopters, and pallets of our cash." He added America's capabilities to deal with the terror threat are greatly exaggerated because Afghanistan is landlocked and surrounded by enemies that have now been emboldened by this foreign policy blunder. He also said that officials have to establish that ISR, or Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance, you know, somewhere over the horizon capability means flying from the Persian Gulf, probably countries like Qatar, which would be, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 hours. Having to fly, you know, over Pakistan gets refueling.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. The program aims to discuss the most significant issues in the subcontinent that affect the governments, communities, organizations, and the region as a whole. As usual, we will try to explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at Kashmir, 2 years after the Indian government revoked the so-called semi-autonomy that had been guaranteed in the Indian constitution. And we shall talk about the mourning of Muharram across the subcontinental nations to commemorate the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad.
In early August 2019, India revoked nearly all of Article 370 in the Constitution, which means the government stripped Jammu and Kashmir, as is called by New Delhi, of a so-called semi-autonomy that had been guaranteed in the Indian Constitution. At the time, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP-led government tried to justify the move as a measure towards stability and economic prosperity for the region. 2 years have passed, but how has the revocation of Article 370 changed the political and security situation in the valley?
Once called heaven on earth, Kashmir is now among the most dangerous flashpoints of the world, sandwiched between Pakistan and India, turning it into hell with rising militarization and militancy. The Muslim-majority Himalayan region is held by India and Pakistan in parts, but claimed by both in full, except for a small sliver that is controlled by China. There are Indian-administered and Pakistani-administered Kashmir, but none of the two governments nor the residents can live with the status quo. While leaving the subcontinent, the British colonialists enabled a division of country on religious grounds, with the Muslim-dominated regions becoming a part of Pakistan and others staying a part of India. As per the partition formula, Kashmir could have gone to Pakistan, as was expected by the Pakistani leadership. But the Hindu king was not ready to make an immediate decision and signed a standstill agreement with Pakistan, presumably to keep the flow of trade, communication, and travel.
The Muslim-majority mountainous valley has been a center of conflicts and even wars between the two nuclear-armed neighbors since the 1947 partition of British India. For decades, the uneasy stalemate has prevailed, broken by occasional military incursions, militant attacks, and police crackdowns. However, Modi's move to integrate Kashmir into India have started widespread uncertainties for the inhabitants of the region who have seen decades of protests and crackdowns.
Over the last few decades, successive Indian governments tried to mute the voice of popular politicians in Kashmir, while an uprising continued in favor of independence. This has claimed thousands of lives and continues to make the territory a hotbed of militancy with no sight of resolution, as neither side is willing to sit down for talks and deliberate on the voice of the people. Despite efforts by the United Nations or other such organizations to mediate the Kashmir dispute, India and Pakistan continue to administer or occupy their portions of the former princely territory while seeking to get full control of it. Troops on both sides of the so-called line of control regularly fire volleys at each other, but there may be more unexpected developments following New Delhi's move, about which Islamabad said it would exercise all possible options to counter the illegal steps. Since 2019, the Indian government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion among locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's Muslim-majority region. Some believe that the government may be eyeing building Hindu settlements or other ways to promote right-wing Hindutva ideas in a bid to change the Muslim character of the Himalayan region. New Delhi had apparently given an initial permission, which was later revoked, for annual Muharram processions in Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar. Activists in Kashmir saw it as a mischievous move by the nationalist Hindu government in New Delhi to stoke the flames of sectarianism in Kashmir Valley.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Sayed Zafar Mehdi, journalist and analyst. First of all, welcome to the program. Mr. Mehdi, on the 5th of August 2019, India revoked nearly all of Article 370 in the Constitution, stripping Jammu and Kashmir of semi-autonomy it had been guaranteed in the Indian Constitution. Now, could you tell us how the revocation of Article 370 has changed the political and security situation in the valley, and for good or the bad?
Well, the best reflection of the situation in Kashmir 2 years down the line are those desolate streets manned by Indian soldiers, the businesses that have suffered losses worth billions of dollars, families who are running around seeking justice for their young children who are framed under draconian laws like Public Safety Act, political leaders and activists who continue to be under house arrest. That's how political and social situation in Kashmir has all changed in Kashmir in these 2 years. The abrogation of Article 370, which gives special status to the disputed region of Kashmir under the Indian Constitution, has compounded the misery of Kashmiris, brought more persecution, and snatched their most fundamental human rights. Why I say more is because it's been a long struggle against the military occupation and for freedom with dignity. When we look at a larger picture, this move doesn't count much because the struggle in Kashmir is for the larger goal. But this latest illegal move 2 years ago has only exposed the Indian government's hidden agenda in Kashmir, which is to change the demography, the Muslim majority character of the state on the model of Palestine. The idea behind this move, choreographed by the nationalist Hindu movement, Hindu government in New Delhi, was to integrate the disputed region of Kashmir into the Indian Union against the wishes of the people there. And they went to the extreme to pull it through by imprisoning their own loyal political allies in Kashmir, not to talk of pro-independence leaders, and by making mockery of their own laws. But as we can see now, the move has backfired. Today, not only the general population in Kashmir, but even the mainstream pro-India political leadership feels alienated. They don't see India as their well-wisher anymore, and this is what the abrogation of Article 370 has done. So the writing is on the wall. India may grab the land by force, but it cannot win the hearts and minds of people in Kashmir. It's as simple as that.
Mr. Mehti, militant groups have intensified their operations in the last 2 years. Some reports say more and more local young people are being drawn towards these groups that are active in the area since India revoked its special status for Kashmir. How do you assess the threat?
Well, the insurgency against the Indian rule in Kashmir dates back to late 1980s. Many militant groups have been active in the valley, in the Kashmir valley, for the past 3 decades, fighting the Indian forces. But in recent years, there has been a remarkable shift, especially since the killing of a young militant commander, Burhan Wani, in 2016. There's more local youth joining this movement, and notably most of these have been educated with promising future ahead of them. But they choose to take up arms because they felt there was no option, no other option. The resistance movement becoming homegrown, becoming indigenous, is a fact acknowledged today by the radical Indian voices too. Indian Prime Minister Modi justified his decision of abrogating Article 370, the special status for Kashmir, 2 years ago, saying it was stoking militancy. But if we look at the records from 2019, these 2 years, the militancy has not only carried on, but it has intensified, even as counterinsurgency operations have also gained pace. According to some reports, official reports, around 2,200 militants are presently active in Kashmir, and majority of them are locals. And in the last 6 months alone, more than 880 militants, as per the official record, have taken up arms against the Indian rule in Kashmir. So numbers surely don't lie. While I would stop short of attributing this surge in militancy to the August 5 decision taken by the Indian government, because the ultimate goal of these fighters is not reinstatement of Kashmir's special status under the Indian Constitution or even statehood. The goal here is freedom from the Indian military occupation. Everyone who knows Kashmir can tell you this thing. But yes, the attempt to dilute the disputed nature of Kashmir, the and attempt to integrate the state in the Indian Union has definitely provoked the Kashmir's indigenous militant outfits.
Thank you, Mr. Mehti. Now let's take a break and look how the global media has covered the anniversary of the Article 370 revocation by the Indian government.
The administration of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, a 70-year-old provision that had given autonomy to the state of Jammu and Kashmir. The government also introduced a bill to strip the region of statehood and divide it into two parts, both under direct control of the central government. But Mr. Modi, a Hindu nationalist, has campaigned for re-election in part by stoking patriotic fervor against Pakistan. He promised the full integration of Kashmir, a cause which his party has championed for decades, and now he is delivering on that pledge. The controversial move by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government unleashed widespread unrest and was followed by an increased deployment of troops in India-administered Kashmir, which was already heavily militarized. A strict security lockdown was imposed that lasted over a year, along with a communications blackout and months-long internet shutdown. During the crackdown, more than 100 Kashmiri politicians were arrested, while thousands of pro-autonomy activists were detained. 2 years later, analysts say Muslims living in India-administered Kashmir continue to fear being disempowered and reduced to second-class citizens. The very nature of the decisions taken on August the 5th was aimed at political disempowerment of one dominant community. That's the primary concern of people here.
Welcome back. Mr. Mehti, since 2019, the government has altered property rights of locals, triggering widespread suspicion amongst locals that the new laws are part of Modi's scheme to change the demography of India's only Muslim-majority region. Now, my question is, has the government succeeded to promote right-wing Hindutva, and has the Indian government succeeded in creating Hindu settlements there on the model of Palestine in a bid to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region?
Well, the abrogation of Article 370 to end the special status of Jammu and Kashmir state was a long-standing demand of the nationalist Hindu party in Delhi, the BJP, which is presently ruling India. One of the main objectives behind this move was to change the Muslim-majority character of the Himalayan region, and by allowing Hindus in mainland India to come and buy properties in Kashmir Valley, replicating the Israeli model in Palestine. Under Article 370 and Article 35A, which is part of this article, people from outside Kashmir, non-Kashmiris, were not allowed to buy land in Kashmir. But this article, when they revoked this article 2 years ago, everything changed. According to the last census, which was in 2011, the population of entire Jammu and Kashmir state is around 12.5 million, which has increased now. And Muslims comprise around 70% of this population. Since August 5, 2 years ago, 2019, Delhi has unilaterally introduced laws related to law and domicile status, which clearly and emphatically seek to change Kashmir's demography and economically disempower Kashmiris. Scores of Indian Hindus from mainland India have already been given domicile certificates and under this new citizenship law, under which non-Kashmiris are now entitled to jobs and residency in Kashmir, which was otherwise reserved only for the local Kashmiris before this article was revoked. So it's quite clear there were the designs of India's ruling BJP party has in Kashmir, despite all the tall talk about economic progress and social empowerment. So it's clear.
Before we take a break, I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Mehti for being on the program. Now let's see how people on social media see the situation in Kashmir.
Former Kashmir lawmaker Mohammad Yusuf Tarigami says the abrogation of Article 370 by New Delhi delegitimized the mainstream political space in Kashmir. He was one of the senior pro-India politicians put under house arrest on August the 5th, 2019. Another tweet is by Satindra Kulkarni. That's an Indian politician and newspaper columnist. Those who believe that measures taken on August the 5th, 2019 solved the Kashmir issue have fallen victim to propaganda. He asserts that Kashmiris feel hurt, humiliated and betrayed. E. Chidambaram calls the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir an unconstitutional coup and the desecration of democracy, while expressing solidarity with the people of the troubled state.
Every year, on the early days of Muharram, a great number of Muslims and non-Muslims across the world mark the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them. Mourners take to the streets for rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month to pay their respect and express the unison amongst all Muslim communities in the love for Imam Hussein.
Every year, Shia Muslims, along with a lot of other people around the world, hold mourning rituals during the first 10 days of the Islamic lunar month of Muharram. The mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein and his companions reach their peak on the 9th day of Muharram, or Taswa, and the 10th day, or Ashura. Ashura marks the martyrdom anniversary of Hussein ibn Ali, Hazrat Imam Hussein, who was martyred in the Battle of Karbala in October 680 AD, or Muharram in 61 AH, nearly 14 centuries ago. The accounts of his heartbreaking martyrdom sent shockwaves through the Muslim world as he was widely seen as a hero who sacrificed his life to challenge the corrupt ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah.
Imam Hussein's message is an iconic message. It's a message that crosses all nationalities, all religions, anyone who has a heart beating in their chest can actually appreciate and understand. Because there are many aspects, as I said, you know, the martyrdom of his, you know, six-month-old baby, Hazrat Ali Azhar, or his son, 18-year-old son, Ali Akbar, being martyred, or his brother, Hazrat Abbas, who, you know, was a commander of the army, or, you know, Imam Hussein's friend coming to join him when he was in his late 80s. So all kinds of fascinating human angles come out of it. Secondly, of course, you know, the viciousness of Yazid's oppression against this small group of people who were standing against the oppressor, the oppressive regime of that time, also resonates very well with the current circumstances of what's happening globally, if you like. That's why, you know, I talked about in the historical sense, but if you look at it in the last 30, 40 years, since the advent of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, where Imam Khomeini actually used the iconography of Karbala to motivate the Iranian masses, similarly, you know, people in the subcontinent and far afield, even in other places, can actually resonate very well that, you know, what is oppression and so on.
Morning of Muharram is an opportunity to unite all Muslims behind the cause of Imam Hussein's uprising against tyranny. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims, myriads of other ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the subcontinent consider Imam Hussein as a symbol of resistance and protest against the oppressive powers.
The people of the subcontinent are no stranger to revolt against imperialism due to their shared history of occupation and exploitation. The Muslim community or any other people who feel oppressed and voiceless can view the mourning of Muharram and Imam Hussein as the great unifier. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, Bangladesh and the rest of South Asia act as one body towards feasible solutions for other problems of the Islamic population.
This year's Muharram comes at a time when mourning ceremonies are held under many pandemic-related health protocols amid fears of another devastating wave of the coronavirus. Indoor gatherings are prohibited, while mourners were advised to hold the rituals in open areas such as squares and streets, instead of traditional places such as mosques and Husseinias.
If you look at India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, the whole population of that big mass of land, which is also in old historical maps called Barre-Saghir, meaning, you know, a continent in its own right, the population of that region is 1.6 billion, 1.7 billion, out of which about 400 to 500 million are Muslims, 250 million in India, 220 million in Pakistan, and another about 160 odd million in Bangladesh. Muslims I'm talking about. So you're talking about at least half a billion Muslims living in that big landmass. And normally statistics are that between 20 to 25% constitute Shias, if you like.
So you're talking about well over 100 million Shias living in the subcontinent, more than Iranian population, and perhaps if you add together the whole of the West Asia, there are more Shias living in the subcontinent than the whole of West Asia. So you can see the numbers are quite huge. So of course, you know, historically, as I said earlier, the impact of Imam Hussein's message has been profound, and of course, historically, a lot of Iranians from Iran during Nadir Shah and subsequently moved to, and I'm not talking about the Parsis who were Zoroastrians who moved to India, but also the followers of the Ahlul Bayt who moved to India over the last 300-400 years. They also brought the custom and the practice of Azadari to the Indian subcontinent. And there are two key places, if you like, in India where the whole Azadari took root. One is Hyderabad Dakhan in the south of India, and the other is Lucknow. These were two princedoms, if you like. Nizam of Hyderabad was a remarkable character, although he came from a Sunni school of thought, but he was a lover of Ahlul Bayt, and he provided a lot of facilities, built a lot of Husseiniyas, provided educational facilities, and the impact of Azadari was quite profound on the subcontinent.
Members of the mourning congregation stage processions, listening to eulogies about Imam Hussein while beating drums as a symbol of remembering the Battle of Karbala. As well as weeping and beating chests, votive cooking or Nazri is an integral part of the ceremonies. Nazri foods are served or distributed among the mourners and passers-by.
And that was our episode on the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir 2 years after the controversial revocation of the so-called semi-autonomous status. We also talked about the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, that are held annually during the first days of Muharram. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight. The Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Emma Graham Harrison and Akhtar Mohammad Makoui. The piece is titled, Taliban Name All-Male Afghan Cabinet, Including Minister Wanted by FBI. Stay with us for more. Taliban have announced an all-male caretaker government, including an interior minister wanted by the FBI, on a day when at least two people were killed by violent policing of street protests against the new authorities in Afghanistan. The leadership, unveiled on Tuesday, 7th of September, is drawn entirely from Taliban ranks. Despite promises of an inclusive cabinet and many of its senior figures are on United Nations sanctions list, which is likely to complicate the group's search for international recognition. Late on Tuesday, 7th of September, a U.S. State Department spokesman said, "We note the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates and no women. We also are concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of the individuals. We understand that the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. However, we will judge the Taliban by its actions and not by its words." The U.S. State Department renewed its call on the Taliban to offer safe passage to U.S. citizens as well as to Afghan citizens looking to leave the country. Afghanistan will once more be officially known as an Islamic Emirate, as it was under Taliban rule in the 1990s. The Prime Minister will be Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund, one of the founding members of the group, who was close to its original leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar. He has had far less international exposure than other senior Taliban leaders, but as head of the group's powerful leadership council, he is one of its most influential members. Mullah Muhammad Omar's son, Mullah Yaqub, will be defense minister in the new caretaker government, and the acting interior minister is Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is on the FBI wanted list. In his first statement since the Taliban seized power last month, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund said Afghanistan's new rulers were committed to all international laws, treaties and commitments not in conflict with Islamic law. In the future, all matters of governance and life in Afghanistan will be regulated by laws of Holy Sharia, he said. The Taliban face a major economic crisis, domestic pressure from political opponents, and an uprising in Panjshir Valley that has not been entirely stamped out despite their capture of the provincial capital in Panjshir. International pressures were highlighted by protests in Kabul